Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If it's 6 minutes after noon Central Time, you're catching today's show live. But if you happen to be listening to the evening rebroadcast at 9 or to a podcast, what you hear right now is a playback of recorded sound. Big deal, right? These days we take for granted that we listen to music on demand, leave voicemails, and follow directions spoken by our GPS devices. So to appreciate how revolutionary sound recording is, consider this. Centuries before we invented photography, artists were able to draw and paint and sculpt things that appeared pretty real. But until great scientific minds took up the challenge of recording audio, every sound in the history of the world was lost forever as soon as it was uttered. A new exhibition at the Smithsonian explores the work of the early pioneers of recording and replaying sound, with a focus on the contributions of a man better known for inventing the telephone, Alexander Graham Bell. Carlene Stevens is curator of the Division of Work and Industry at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History, which recently completed a project that definitively identified the only known recording of the voice of Alexander Graham Bell. The exhibition Hear My Voice is on display through January at the Smithsonian. There's also a terrific online exhibition you can explore through the Smithsonian's website. The exact link is available at kera.org/thinkindc. Carlene, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
I really do like thinking about how much was lost, or I don't like thinking about it, but it's remarkable to think about how many sounds we've never heard, how many voices we can't imagine, because for a very long time in human history, we couldn't record it.
It's fascinating to me, too, especially in a world where, as you mentioned, we take for granted being able to replay sound, a world where we're saturated with recorded sound, to think that there is a very large chunk of human history where that was not possible. And we're in an era now where it is also frightening to consider how many recordings from the earliest days of recorded sound are basically unplayable. If you think about how many format changes have happened in just your lifetime, maybe from the Walkman of Sony to the Apple iPhone, the format change means that what you had before often becomes unplayable.
So this is something that historians and archivists want to, prevent to the extent possible. The folks at the Smithsonian have, really created a new technology for taking old recordings and finding ways to play them without actually physically touching them?
Well, actually, the Smithsonian is the beneficiary of the work of others mm-hmm. who have done that. In the case of our Volta recordings, we have benefited from the work of partners at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California, and their work with the Library of Congress here in Washington. About 10 years ago now, our partner Carl Haber from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, was listening to an NPR report by Mickey Hart. And Mickey Hart was talking about all of the endangered recordings around the world that might be lost, that were lost, were unplayable. And Carl is a physicist by day. He works on particle physics. He is part of these experiments at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. And he wondered, in listening to this report, if the instruments that he uses to measure things in the physics experiments might be repurposed to help with some of these endangered recordings. And when I say endangered, there are old formats that are dirty, broken, moldy, cracked, delaminating in various states of disrepair. And they're basically considered unplayable because either people don't have the machine to play the thing back, or the damage is done and the record can't sustain it. So what Carl came up with was a non-contact method using light to recover sound, and coupled that with computer magic.
So what happens is there's an image taken of whatever the recording is. I suppose this doesn't work for tapes, but it does work for things like records that have grooves in them. Is that right?
That's right. It's a process that works on mechanical carriers of sound, and the sound is in the groove. Yes.
I like that. The sound is in the groove.
Yes.
Well, let's jump back in history a little bit. How did and when did scientists start to understand the physics of sound at all, to the extent that they could begin to play with it and think about how it might be recorded?
Well, the study of sound is ancient, but I would say that modern methods of thinking about and trying to identify sound as a physical phenomenon that are directly in line with this kind of sound recording are 19th century. And in the middle of the 19th century, there were efforts to identify exactly what sound was. And because people understood writing and visual representations of phenomena, a lot of the early efforts to understand sound depicted sound. There was a French stenographer, typographer, interested in the visual effects of reading, obviously, who thought if it was possible to make a picture of sound repeatedly, say an opera singer's opus, it would be possible to study those pictures of sound and express the quality of that sound. What was it that made the sound so wonderful? So this French stenographer is Léon Scott de Maltenville, and with lots of help, he devised an instrument to make pictures of sound. It basically was a hand-cranked cylinder around which he wrapped a piece of paper, and he put soot all over the paper and then used a needle to inscribe through the soot. And the needle responded to a vibrating diaphragm, and the diaphragm responded to sound waves. So someone would talk at this machine, the needle would vibrate and scratch in the soot, and the resulting image was an image of the sound wave. This is something that Léon Scott designed and then patented and then redesigned with the help of other people. He might have had some success reading these devices, reading these results of his sound wave experiments, but it didn't really catch on, except that the instrument became the principal device for demonstrating that sound traveled in waves.
Wow.
It became a physics demonstration piece. It became the instrument that every single school, every single acoustic lab would have to make this demonstration. And the Smithsonian bought one.
Was his idea, Martinville's, that someday somebody might be able to read these and it would function as almost a dictation device? Is that what he was imagining the practical application might be?
That, I suppose that's one aspect of it. The most important thing to remember is that this instrument could record sound, but it could not play it back. No sound came out of it in the end.
It's amazing to think that it took that much just to record sound, and then nobody knew quite what to do with that ability.
It it was a time of discovery in sound, yes.
So how did Alexander Graham Bell transition from his work in speech and hearing, which was his original career, into electrical technologies?
Alexander Graham Bell's research interests were in hearing and speech. He came from a long line of speech teachers. His grandfather was a speech teacher. His father was a speech teacher. The fancy 19th century word is elocutionist, which I really like. And he visited the secretary of the Smithsonian. The head of the Smithsonian is called the secretary. As he was trying to understand sound and electrical technologies, he had some ideas. He worked hard. He imagined. He kept voluminous notes. But he said to the secretary, "I'm really interested in this project. I think there's something to be done here, but I just don't have the technical background." And the secretary of the Smithsonian, Joseph Henry, reportedly said to him, "Well, if you don't have it, go and get it." And so there was a lot of self-study, mm-hmm. that self-directed study, I should say. And Bell got his hands on everything that he could read about electrical technologies. He experimented a lot. That was his method, to experiment, to adopt or to adapt his ideas through experimentation. And he always had help. He always had good mechanical and electrical help from various people. Watson, of course, of the telephone. And in the case of the sound recording, his main helpers were another instrument maker named Charles Sumner Tainter and his cousin, Chichester Bell, who was a chemist.
So we have the work going on with Bell and his associates, and of course people are maybe more familiar with what was happening at Edison's labs. But Edison had made something in 1887 that seemed to work and then gave up on it temporarily.
Edison was working on a variety of things, and in 1877, several versions of what ultimately becomes the phonograph emerge. And there was instant, crazy reaction to the phonograph because it was the first time ever that sound was played and then stored and then played back. Leon Scott de Mountainville had recorded sound, but he couldn't play it back. So along comes Edison, and if you look at de Mountainville's machine, which he called the phonautograph, and you look at Edison's machine, which he called the phonograph or talking machine, there are striking similarities. There's a drum. The drum is wrapped with the recording medium. In de Mountainville's case, it was the sooted paper I mentioned. In Edison's case, it was a strip of tinfoil.
We'll talk about how that worked out in just a moment with my guest, Carlene Stevens. She is curator of the Division of Work and Industry at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. The exhibition Hear My Voice is on display at the Smithsonian through January and also online. You can explore that through the Smithsonian's website, and you can find the link on the Think page. You can also check out the Think Tumblr, KERA Think Tumblr. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Live from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the curator of the Division of Work and Industry at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. There's an exhibition on display there called Hear My Voice through January. You can also find it online. We're speaking with curator Carlene Stevens this hour, and if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Carlene, so we have Edison, and he has created his phonograph, and he's recording on tin foil. Is that right?
A sheet of tin foil wrapped around a cylinder, and a stylus, a needle, is indenting the tin foil in response to sound waves, roughly interpreted. The astonishment with which this invention was received basically earned Edison the reputation of the Wizard of Menlo Park. Mm-hmm. This was such a new and awe-inspiring invention. So Edison actually went on the road with the phonograph and held lots of demonstrations of it for about a year. And everywhere he went, everywhere his demonstrators went with their phonographs, crowds assembled. They received little snippets of the tinfoil as souvenirs of the experience. And there was a very enthusiastic reception of the phonograph. But after about a year of this, the enthusiasm died down. Edison turned to other pursuits, like inventing the electric light bulb, as it's usually said. He turned his attention to improving the electric light bulb. And the flaws of his phonograph, which as interesting as it was, as amazing as it was, did have flaws, the flaws became apparent. The playback, the ability to play back with a sheet of tinfoil was limited.
It would degrade as you used it over and over.
Exactly. We have an example of an Edison tinfoil recording in our collection at the museum. And it looks as though it was a piece of foil that somebody wrapped a sandwich in, ate the sandwich, crumbled up the foil, threw it away, and then got it out again, smoothed it, tried to straighten it out. It just was not a durable medium. And frankly, the sound reproduction wasn't very good. So Edison had licensed his invention in several different directions. He gave a license to one group of investors to develop the phonograph as a business dictation device. He licensed another group to turn it into a toy. It wasn't clear what this thing was going to be. So the first group I mentioned, the business dictation investors, one of the key people in that group was Alexander Graham Bell's father-in-law. And you can imagine the conversation. Mr. Hubbard turns to Mr. Bell and says, "Can't you improve this?" So with funding that Alexander Graham Bell received from the French government,
as a big prize for inventing the telephone.
That's right. Bell establishes a laboratory right here in Washington, D.C. He enlists the help of his cousin, Chichester, and the mechanic I mentioned, Charles Sumner Tainter, and they become the Volta Associates. And indeed, what they try to do is improve on the Edison phonograph.
One of the things they looked at was the potential of using all kinds of different media for recording onto. Tell us a little bit about what they tried and what they ultimately realized would be, at that time, the very best solution.
One of the startling revelations to me in looking at the history of those experiments is that the evidence is really obvious about the different materials, the different methods, the successes, the failures, in our collection of about 400 of these experiments. So it's possible in looking at that collection to see that they tried wax. They tried different combinations of different kinds of waxes. They tried wax and paraffin. They tried plaster. They tried foil. They tried plaster under foil. They tried cardboard. The array is really startling. They actually used metal in some cases as a substrate. They demonstrated very early on they were thinking about reproducing recordings from a master. With Edison's machine, it was one record recorded at a time. So every recording was an original, to put it another way. And so very early on, the Volta Associates, as they came to be called, because the French prize was named the Volta Prize, the Volta Associates were interested to know whether it was possible to make copies from a master.
So they finally decided that wax was their favorite medium. Is that correct?
Yes. Very early experiments involved applying a layer of wax to an Edison phonograph. And so that set of experiments happened in about 1881. They move away from wax on a cylinder and try wax and other materials on discs. And for about 4 years, they're experimenting with different flat surfaces and different cylindrical surfaces. And when they finally go to write up a patent description and file for a patent, they describe many of these processes, but ultimately the commercial product that's a success from all of this experimentation is a wax cylinder recording and a machine to record and play back on, which they called the graphophone. By now you've got the phonautograph of Leon Scott de Martinville, you've got the phonograph of Edison. Now onto the scene comes the graphophone of the Volta Associates. Very complicated set of syllables moving around.
So you have 400 extant recordings, or the museum does in its collection, and one of them is something that turned out to be a real find, which is the only recording we know of, right, of the voice of Alexander Graham Bell. We're going to play this here, and he says, "Hear my voice, Alexander Graham Bell." And I tell you that because we can see that recording technology has come a long way. You have to listen really closely, but let's hear this original and the only recording we know of. There it is. Nobody knew that was there until this technology was created a few years ago in California to allow these recordings to be resurrected.
Right. This is a bit of a complicated episode in our experiments with trying to recover sound from these 400 recordings. The recording sat at the Smithsonian for about a century. We had...
Bell himself had brought a whole collection of things to the museum.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. In 1914 and 1915, as gifts to the Smithsonian, where he was the regent. He was part of our governing board. So the intent of Bell was to, after delivery, come to the museum and make extensive notes about everything. And it didn't happen. So as a result, we had very sketchy information about what was the content on these recordings. It was pretty obvious what the materials were, but even there, it's a little mysterious sometimes. But 400 records, and we have almost no information about what's on them. So in 2011, when we were deep into the sound recovery process, a scholar from Indiana University, Patrick Feaster, came to the museum on a fellowship, and he and I sat and looked at every single recording. He took down all of the inscriptions on every recording, and there were many. And he went to the Library of Congress and looked at the Bell Laboratory notebooks that are there. He looked at the Charles Sumner Tainter notebooks that are in the National Museum of American History Archive Center, and annotated his observations of those recordings with the notebook information about the experiments. And in that process, there was one recording that had a date of April 15th, 1885. And there was a piece of paper also in storage that had a transcription and Alexander Graham Bell's signature on the bottom with that very date. And the transcription was really weird. It was a list of numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. And so on and so on and so on. With this Hear My Voice, Alexander Graham Bell, the very last bit of it. So we pulled that recording out for sound recovery. We thought, maybe this is really the only confirmed voice of Alexander Graham Bell on this recording. And sure enough, that's what it was.
That had to be an exciting confirmation.
It really was. It was a two-day process on the part of Carl Haber and Peter Allier at the Library of Congress. And Carl had scanned it the first day and heard numbers. So we still didn't really know because we didn't get to the juicy bit at the end where he says Alexander Graham Bell. And overnight, Carl had listened to the whole recording. He sent an email early the next day to me and my colleague, Sherry Stout, who was participating in all of this by helping at the Library of Congress. And Sherry and I are driving for a second day to from the National Museum of American History up the hill to the Library of Congress. And Sherry is playing that sound recording that you just played here. She's playing it for me as I drive on her iPhone. So I heard Alexander Graham Bell's voice for the first time on her phone.
So, Carlene, as people know, the world remembers the phonograph, and yet there was the graphophone. What did the design innovations of the graphophone contribute to what would later be the truly successful, refined design of the phonograph? What did Bell's work contribute to the success that Edison ultimately would have commercially?
Well, I think if anybody thinks about this history at all, if anybody has a little bit of knowledge about it, they associate the successful phonograph with Edison. This episode with Bell is not very well known, if known at all. There's another individual named Emil Berliner who is credited with perfecting the disc recording, which we know. But again, overshadowed by Edison. And largely, the success of Bell's graphophone and the cylinder were what inspired Edison to come back into the phonograph business. He had abandoned it for other pursuits. And so by the late 1880s, when the Volta Associates have patented their graphophone and patented their cylinder recording, Edison comes back on the scene. And he says, oh, cylinder, recording, wax, I think I'll do that. And he has to license it from the Volta Associates. In the meantime, also here in Washington, D.C., Emil Berliner is aware of the Volta work. There's an interweaving in the 1870s and 1880s with the work of Emil Berliner, Alexander Graham Bell, and Edison on sound recording, microphone, telegraph, telephone. They are all contributing to each other's work in these new media of the 19th century. So what ultimately emerges from all of this pioneering work is a scene where cylinders and discs as recording media coexist for a while, and gradually the cylinders fall out of favor for home entertainment, but stay very much in use in two other areas. One area really is the business dictation.
The dictaphone.
Yes, exactly. And the Ediphone, because Edison had his own version of it.
Of course.
And Edison and Bell had both envisioned their earliest work to be aimed at business dictation. They were serving the business community. Bell's telephone was envisioned as a device for the business world. And talk about unanticipated consequences. So business dictation and cylinders also endure. They find a new use among anthropologists and ethnologists. Field work, recording Native American languages, foreign languages.
We're speaking this hour with Carlene Stevens, curator of the Division of Work and Industry at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. The museum recently completed a project that definitively identified the only known recordings, or features a project, the only known recordings of the voice of Alexander Graham Bell. It's called Hear My Voice. You can find it online. And, of course, if you happen to be in Washington, D.C. through January, you can see it here. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and we will take your calls. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. Today is the last day of our week in D.C. You can check out behind-the-scenes action on our new Tumblr, kerathink.tumblr.com. I'm speaking this hour with Carlene Stevens of the Smithsonian Institution. The exhibition Hear My Voice, about the contributions of Alexander Graham Bell to recorded and replayed sound, is on display through January at the museum. You can also find an online exhibition at the Smithsonian's website. Join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Carlene, it's so interesting when you think about the history of technology, which is what you specialize in. It moves so quickly now that most of us just sort of drop what happened before and we're eager to move on to the next thing. What do we lose out on if we're not keeping good records and paying attention to the evolutionary steps in the development of our technologies?
Well, I don't think everybody has to pay attention. But that does seem to be what historians and archivists and museum curators do. And we do it because we think there's value in knowing what has gone before so that we can be good stewards of the past, but also good ancestors to the future.
Hmm. Do you find that records kept of failures are as helpful to the study of history as records kept of successes? Like, you have to know both, right?
Yes. And relative to this particular episode of sound recording, there is a very telling episode where Edison, who is revered as the ultimate inventor, has a major disaster on his hands. He licensed the ability to turn the phonograph into a toy. The first licensees completely failed on their own. And the second group decided that what they really wanted to do was put the phonograph inside a doll and to have a talking doll. And
like the kind you pull a string out of the back, that sort of doll?
Well, that's the present end of it, like the hot end of it, if you want to say it that way. But the cool end of it was to actually have a record on a little phonograph inside the doll that would have been activated by turning a crank. Mm-hmm. The crank would make the phonograph rotate and the cylinder would rotate. So that's the equivalent of pulling the string on the, what was it, Chatty Cathy
Chatty
doll.
Chatty Cathy,
yes,
sure.
Yes, exactly. So dolls, of course, were very popular at the end of the 19th century worldwide. And so why not have a talking doll? So they made these instruments to put inside dolls. They acquired dolls from doll manufacturers, and the dolls were universally disliked. Hmm. They were large. They were verging on 3 feet tall. they reportedly frightened children with their recordings, which were harmless, relatively harmless nursery rhymes, mm-hmm. but they were so not high fidelity, high-pitched, squeaking female voices that they didn't sell well. They broke frequently and basically caused Edison to retrench. Reportedly, he buried the remaining unsold phonograph parts of the doll on the grounds of his laboratory and got rid of the dolls by other means. A complete disaster in terms of a direction to take an invention. And I think these episodes, successful and unsuccessful, indicate how complex invention and innovation, the process of getting from an idea to a commercial product, a successful, widely adopted commercial product, how complex that really is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Mike in Las Colinas. Hi, Mike.
Yes, another great show. Fantastic.
Thank you.
My question to your guest is there any plans to take this show on the road? My experience has been that when I show my music students the evolution of the technology, their jaw just drops because they just don't know how that technology has evolved. So I'm just interested to know if you're going to put the show on the road. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Will the exhibition travel?
The exhibition won't travel. It actually has a very short shelf life on display because of the fragility of the documents. We've already had to replace the original transcript with Alexander Graham Bell's signature with a reproduction, as much as we hate to do that because people come to see the real thing. Light is the enemy. So having these things out in the light of day actually is harmful. So I'm really sorry, but there is a website that's available, and maybe that would help your students. I would love to know how your students react to the website.
We do have a link to that site from the Think page, so you can get to it easily there. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Chris on the line in Arlington. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Right, I had a comment on the phono autograph that your guest mentioned a little earlier. Mm-hmm. I recently stumbled upon an internet page about that, and apparently the paper transcriptions of sound have been scanned into a computer recently, and they've managed to take that waveform and, by using the computer, turn it into playable sound. So there's now a playable sound of those recordings that I think predate the Edison and the phonograph by decades, and you can hear them. If you just Google phonoautograph, you'll probably find the page. But it's pretty interesting. It's I think one of the songs is Clair de Lune, and it's some opera stuff and people talking, but just wanted to make sure that got out there.
Well, thanks so much for your call, Chris. What do you know about that, Carlene?
Well, yes, your caller is absolutely right. It's fascinating to be able to get sound from these phonautograms that were never intended to produce sound. And it's the same sound recovery process that we were able to benefit from on the Volta Laboratory recordings that recovered the sound from the paper. It's the Berkeley Library of Congress group technology, and the scholars who found the phonautograms in the French archives are under an umbrella called First Sounds. I think that's the it's on their website that these sounds are audible.
Now that the technology exists, is it pretty cost-effective to take an old record of some kind and use this, this visual technology to reproduce the sound or preserve the sound?
In the case of our recordings, every effort, every new recording is an experiment. The process, the technology was originally conceived to recover sound from commercial formats, commercial discs, commercial cylinders. And when commercial discs and cylinders undergo this process, it goes very smoothly. The techniques have been in use now for about a decade, and they've demonstrated repeatedly how useful they are. Our things are much more experimental. Cost-effective probably just didn't even enter into it at all.
I was fascinated by this. Bell's notes indicate that he was at least thinking about the ability to transmit sound across light.
Yes. He actually came up with a device for doing that in a set of experiments. The device was called the photophone. These syllables of light and sound and distance get rearranged so many different times. The photophone experiments were also done here in Washington, D.C., right before he took up the efforts to experiment with recording sound. And because of the experience Bell had with challenges to the telephone, he decided to be active, proactive, on the defensive with his photophone experiments and his sound recording experiments. So and by that I mean on three separate occasions, in 1880 and 1881, he wrote up his notes with his associates and took his prototypes, demonstrated working prototypes, and sealed all of that in tin boxes. Two for the photophone, one for the sound recording, and he had them deposited at the Smithsonian Institution. In the event that they would be needed for a patent fight.
Which happened all the time, apparently, around the end of the 19th century. Yeah. It was as crazy as it is today.
As crazy as it is today. I think, yes. The photophone prototypes survive in our collection, as well as these tin boxes, which were all opened. There never was a patent fight that required them. And the boxes were opened in the presence of the Bell family, Bell's two daughters and a great-grandson, in 1937.
Is it going too far to say, Carlene, that Bell anticipated something like fiber optic technology?
His photophone is the antecedent to transmitting a message on a light beam, yes. The Volta Associates anticipated fiber optic telephony. They anticipated a tape recorder, although their tape was a piece of paper with wax on it, not an electromagnetic one. They anticipated the way sound is applied to film for moving pictures. So many experiments with sound that we can now identify elements of today, but they didn't pursue all of these.
I can't imagine what, I don't know if it's a series of warehouses or if you have a gigantic basement at the Smithsonian, but I'm sure there are many things in the permanent collection that, you know, with time people will get to and re-examine. How are those decisions made so that something like all of these, you know, sealed containers left by Bell a century ago were brought back up and studied again?
Well, in the case of the Volta materials, it's a very specific inspiration. The first sounds story about extracting or educing sound from the phonautograms was front page news in the New York Times in 2008 or 2009. Mm-hmm. And I read the story. I saw that the Library of Congress was involved, and I got in touch with a former colleague who was head of the preservation directorate there at the Library of Congress when that work was done. And so thus began the whole process of finding out whether this new sound recovery technique would even work on the Volta materials. And we're glad it does.
Carlene Stevens is curator of the Division of Work and Industry at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. It has identified definitively the only known recordings of the voice of Alexander Graham Bell. The exhibition Hear My Voice is on display through January at the Smithsonian. There's also an online exhibition you can explore. The link to that is available on the Think page of KERA.org. Carlene, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Our Think team in Washington includes Stephen Becker and Jeff Whittington. We want to thank all the people from NPR who have made this week possible. Back in Dallas, the show is engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Kristen Taylor helped out on phones today. You can follow the hashtag ThinkInDC this week and get a look at action behind the scenes on our KERA Think Tumblr. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd in Washington this week. Thanks for listening and have a great day.